there is a tendency to over-sedate our patients.
Why is it important to address pain in our critically ill ED patient?
Severe pain, it does impact outcomes if it's not treated appropriately.
Pain should be treated before any sedative agent is considered.
Vital signs are not valid indicators of pain.
We're not just treating the patient in the bed, but we're also treating the family members.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. As always, joined by my stellar co-hosts, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how goes it for this podcast?
Going much better. We got finally some breath of fall air in New Orleans, so it's delightful.
North of Baltimore in Philly.
Things are going great in Philadelphia, Mike. Thanks for asking.
We similarly on the East Coast, Peter, have the chill of the fall. It has certainly turned here and down into the upper 30s it got this morning when we headed out to do a few kid activities. How about on the West Coast, Rob? How are things out there?
Great, great. This is the nicest time of year in terms of weather. Actually, a little bit warmer than it is in the summer, paradoxically.
What many of us, I guess, would consider the, one of our most favorite times of year as we head towards that fall, we head towards the holiday season. Hopefully, all of you are gearing up and making plans to travel to see friends and loved ones throughout the holiday season. Excited to have you listen to this podcast. We're going to talk about some evidence-based medicine, some recent evidence, specifically a publication that just came out a few months ago in Critical Care Medicine, and it deals with a very, very important topic, and that is the treatment of pain as well as anxiety and agitation in our critically ill patient. And we thought this would be very, very timely. Not only do we all care for critically ill patients throughout our ED shifts, but many, as we all know, stay much, much longer. We know that the length of stay for majority of critically ill patients, in fact, recent literature would say more than 87% of ICU patients spend at least 2 hours in our EDs, if not longer. Really, the treatment of pain and agitation and anxiety is paramount. And certainly it's something that we want to focus on and dedicate this podcast to because that recent literature is an update to our previous guidelines that we had talked about many years ago. In fact, the 2018 guidelines are out now for the treatment of pain, agitation, delirium, immobility, and sleep in the critically ill patients. That's what we're going to cover during this podcast. The article itself is by Devlin. It appeared in Critical Care Medicine. We'll have the citation for you in the handout for this podcast. And it is entitled Clinical Practice Guidelines for the Prevention and Management of Pain, Agitation, Sedation, Delirium, Immobility, and Sleep Disruption in Adult Patients in the ICU. Now, certainly it says in the ICU, but for many of us, there's a lot of great pearls throughout this document, throughout these recommendations that are very applicable to the critically ill ED patient who is awaiting transfer upstairs to the ICU. Now, just by way of background, this 2018 guideline really updated the 2013 pain, agitation, and delirium guidelines. They did add, as you heard, immobility as well as sleep to this guidelines. And something that we felt was particularly important is they actually brought in patients and they included them as collaborators and included them as co-authors for this current guideline. In addition, they brought in a number of folks, panelists from multiple areas across the world, really attempting to make a very much more robust, much more diverse practice and expertise from the global critical care community. So overall, what did this document have? Well, they had 37 recommendations. Not surprisingly, when we talk about evidence, the quality of evidence, the majority are conditional recommendations. In fact, only two are strong recommendations. We'll touch on those. They had two overall good practice statements and a whole host of additional statements. But let's actually get two things, guys. Let's actually get to pain, analgesia, and then we'll delve into sedation shortly. John, why is it important to address pain in our critically ill ED patient?
It's a great question, Mike, and I think all of us are aware, particularly in the emergency department, with the challenges that pain presents. And this is not to get into like the opioid epidemic and issues that we're having. The patients we're talking about are critically ill patients, and in these patients, we don't necessarily want to pull back and not treat pain for fear of giving excessive opioids. I think we really have to, in our own departments, have a consistent approach to pain management, and it should be relatively assessment driven. So it should be guided to us by our patients' responses, and there's a few different options for this, which we'll talk about. But the nice thing is that it can be fairly protocolized. So we can come to a consensus at our own individual clinical practice and enable the nurses to really drive this pain management approach. So I think that number one, again, it's important to consistently treat pain. And number two, be aggressive in our critically ill patients. And just because they can't communicate with us does not mean that they're having pain. And so severe pain, it does impact outcomes if it's not treated appropriately. So be aggressive and implement an assessment-driven protocol for how you're managing pain.
Now, in terms of, Peter, those short and both long-term outcomes John alluded to in terms of untreated pain, we do know that when patients experience critical illness, they absolutely remember the pain, the anxiety of that critical illness. And I think depending on which piece of literature you pull, that can range anywhere from 50 upwards of 80 to 90% of ICU patients very much remember the pain of that experience. They remember being intubated, the pain of that endotracheal tube. They remember those lines that we place when we feel that perhaps they're sedated or minimally arousable. They do in fact remember. And the short-term consequences of untreated pain, we know, increased catecholamines, results in increased vasoconstriction, perhaps really impaired tissue perfusion, and increases in myocardial oxygen consumption. Now, something that we didn't talk about ahead of this podcast, but the long-term effects are being written about more and more, and that's ICU syndrome, the family ICU, post-ICU syndrome. It has a variety of names. But I guess let me ask, is this something that you see, this post-ICU syndrome, not only in patients or their family members in the ICU?
I love the idea that you're talking not just about the patient, but also about the family, because there's nothing more distressing than being a family member of someone that the perception is they're being managed poorly for their pain and agitation. Because we're not just treating the patient in the bed, but we're also treating the family members. And in today's emergency departments, we're welcoming families in 24/7. And so it makes things very, very challenging.
Well, let me stick with you, Peter. I love that point. And John alluded to using an assessment-driven pain management protocol. Where does the current guidelines, the document that I referenced to start off and that we're using for the basis of this podcast, what do they recommend, and why are we actually talking about pain first? Don't we usually reach for perhaps propofol or dexmedetomidine?
Well, again, what they think first and foremost is that we should be standardizing this and using protocol-based pain assessment and management. For their good practice statement, they're saying the management of pain for adult ICU patients should be guided by routine pain assessment, and pain should be treated before any sedative agent is considered. So first and foremost, we're going to address the pain. Their recommendation, they suggest using an assessment-driven, protocol-based, stepwise approach for pain and sedation management in critically ill adults. It's a conditional recommendation with a moderate quality of evidence.
Now, in terms of that protocol-based, stepwise approach, Peter, I've heard the concept of analgosedation or analgesia-based sedation. Does that simply mean pain medicine first? And are there any outcome benefits from doing this pain medicine first, this analgosedation type of approach?
Yes, it is. But we have to first back up and understand that it's a conditional recommendation because the benefits of protocol-based approach are not observed across all critical outcomes. But there are a host of outcomes that are tremendously impacted and improved upon. When we think about analgosedation or analgesia-based sedation, we know that this reduces sedative requirements. It actually decreases duration of mechanical ventilation. It decreases ICU length of stay, and it decreases pain intensity. So those are all huge markers. Anything that moves our patients out of the ICUs sooner reduces their risks.
Absolutely agree. Those are great, great outcomes. Now, Rob, I'm going to turn to you. So we're going to start with pain medicine first. This analgo sedation type of approach really does have some improved outcomes associated with it. And in terms of this protocol-based approach, what are the most reliable and valid pain assessment methods? Why isn't it okay to just wait for tachycardia to develop or patients to kind of move around in bed? What are those pain assessment protocols?
Yeah, Mike. So the main point to remember here is that vital signs are not valid indicators of pain, that you can't just rely on vital signs in critically ill patients. Of course, vital signs should be a clue that you need to assess a patient's pain and sedation, but just relying or waiting for tachycardia or increased respiratory rate are not valid measures or valid ways to assess pain. And the most valid ways to assess pain are differentiated into two groups. If, of course, the patient is not intubated and you're able to communicate with the patient, self-report scales are the reference standard, and those should be used. And we're all familiar with 0 to 10 pain scales and pain scales like that. But for the majority of our ICU patients who are either intubated or have altered mental status such that they cannot communicate their pain, you have to use behavioral pain assessment tools. And the two most valid and reliable pain scales are the behavioral pain scale and the critical care pain observation tool. These have been shown to demonstrate the greatest validity and inter-rater reliability. And these are the main ones that should be used.
Outstanding. So we've already got some key pearls. Pain, untreated pain, it makes a difference. Certainly it matters not only in the short term, but in the long term in terms of adverse consequences. Starting off treating pain first and not waiting for vital sign abnormalities to clue us in that the patient needs some type of analgesia. Using a validated protocol, Rob just touched on the behavioral pain scale and the critical care pain observation tool, in those that are not really responsive or able to communicate, having the greatest validity and reliability. So I got that. Now, John, I'm going to turn back to you. How should I go about treating pain now that I know it's important and how to assess it? What do I use?
Okay, so this is pretty easy overall. And I think that everyone's in good agreement that opioids should remain the mainstay of our pain management for most of our patients, whether medical or surgical type critically ill patients. And this can come in any flavor between, you know, fentanyl or Dilaudid, or in some cases even morphine if blood pressure isn't too much of an issue. Obviously, there are some important safety concerns that we're taking into account when we're choosing any medication, such as overall sedation, long-term or short-term delirium, respiratory depression, GI function, and overall increasing length of stay by being overly aggressive if we're not using some sort of subjective or objective pain scale score. And obviously, we know that over-sedating with pain medication can potentially worsen overall ICU outcome. Now, the panel in general, when we're talking about this guidelines, they did support using a multimodal pharmacotherapy approach. So maybe it's worth going over just a few of their recommendations. Now, of all these adjunctive treatments, there was really only one with a strong recommendation and a moderate quality of evidence. The rest of them are largely conditional. And so more or less good to know about, but not necessarily something that we have to change our practice. So the first one's going to be Tylenol. And I think we can all get on board with using Tylenol in some way, shape, or form to try and address pain. And they suggest using it as an adjunct to opioids. And this is a conditional with a low quality of evidence. But, you know, the nice thing about Tylenol is that it's a fairly favorable side effect profile, unless there's acute liver injury that you want to be careful about. It can be given in a multitude of ways, oral, rectal, or IV form. So it's a nice adjunct, and it's something that I routinely use for pain management on a majority of my patients in addition to opioids. Now, of the rest of the adjuncts, the only other one that had a strong recommendation with moderate quality of evidence was the use of neuropathic pain medications. Now, this might be something I think all of us are probably not as traditionally familiar with, so using gabapentin, carbamazepine, and, you know, pregabalin as a choice for analgesia. Now, these types of pain medications, their evidence base was largely in post-operative critically ill patients, so maybe not the medically critically ill. And oftentimes, they have to be given orally, so maybe a little bit of a challenge unless the patient's intubated, has an OG tube. But at least in the post-operative patients, it seems to be something they recommend But in the ED, maybe not something we're routinely using right off the bat. I think something that probably in current years has become more popular is the use of ketamine. And their recommendation was low-dose ketamine being a dose of 1 to 2 mics per kilo per hour as an adjunct should be considered. And again, this is a conditional with a low quality of evidence. Now, it's important to note that ketamine didn't show to improve patient self-reported pain intensity. And overall, the evidence regarding its role in the ICU is fairly limited. And at least I know in Pennsylvania, nurses are not allowed to administer ketamine. It's something that a physician has to administer. And so as you're thinking about starting something like a ketamine infusion, you really have to be careful to make sure that your nurses feel comfortable and it's actually allowable in your institution. Just a couple others we won't touch on that much. IV lidocaine suggested not routinely using IV lidocaine as an adjunct to opioid therapy. Our COX-1 NSAIDs, not routinely using these. Again, being careful, thoughtful about acute kidney injury as the side effect profile might be unfavorable for critically ill patients. And then some small inhaled volatile anesthetics and a few other things that are not routinely recommended. So overall, I think acetaminophen's my go-to for routine use. And then thinking about the neuropathic pain medications if necessary, but usually opioids are 1, 2, and 3 for me.
Outstanding points, John. Before we kind of wrap up analgesia and move on to sedation, Peter, and then Rob, I want to ask you, do you find yourself using a little bit more ketamine? I suspect a lot of our listeners would like to move to this in terms of an adjunct for pain control. Lots written in the EM literature along with the critical care literature. Are you using this in your practice?
So it's a bit tougher for us in Louisiana, again, kind of settled with the same restrictions that John has in Pennsylvania. There's a state law that prevents our nurses from administering it. And so we're going back to the State Board of Medical Society for Louisiana and to the state Senate to try to have legislation passed for more liberal use of ketamine.
Yeah, I'm using ketamine quite a bit. I tend to administer it myself or with one of the residents for intense procedures. Let's say, for example, if I'm going to put in a chest tube on a patient in the ICU or in the ED, I'll use ketamine quite a bit. As far as continuous drips, we're allowed to do that. Our nurses are less comfortable with that, but I'm a huge fan of ketamine and trying to use it more often than not.
I think my experience is very similar to all three of you. In Maryland, there is issues related to the Maryland Board of Nursing. Notwithstanding, our medical center just put together a more comprehensive ketamine document that would include procedural sedation, its administration for excited delirium, and there is a section on analgesia and pain control that may include a continuous infusion. Now, we were able to get both critical care and ED attendings on that, but I will say we have one added resource in that we do have a pain management service that typically will oversee once patients move on to continuous infusions of IV ketamine. A lot of times the pain management service will come and take care of them. But certainly very interesting points, John. Once again, that was great review on terms of the adjuncts from acetaminophen to ketamine to the neuropathic meds, and then really less favorable suggestions or recommendations from these guidelines on lidocaine, the COX-1 NSAIDs, and other agents such as nitric oxide, volatile anesthetics. Well, great points on pain, gentlemen. Some really, really key themes are emerging from pain. Let's kind of move into, in the last half of our discussion here, sedation. Peter, let me turn to you. We talked about the importance of untreated pain. Are there similar adverse consequences for untreated agitation and anxiety?
There are. And so we know that even light sedation is associated with a shorter time to extubation and a reduced tracheostomy rate. However, it's not been associated with a reduction in 90-day mortality. It's not shown to be a reduction in delirium prevalence, the prevalence of PTSD, or self-extubation. So it makes it tough in regards to saying, is it all clear, saying, what are the benefits, right?
Yeah. In terms of that agitation and anxiety, it's been associated with increases in morbidity and mortality. And the previous guidelines, so let's just go back quickly to the 2013 pain, agitation, and delirium guidelines, and they really recommended targeting those lighter levels of sedation and also recommended minimizing the use of benzodiazepines. Peter, I'm going to stick with you for the light sedation concept. Is it still in the 2018 guidelines recommended that we target lighter levels, or should we be taking our patients a little bit deeper in terms of their sedation, making them a little bit less arousable or minimally responsive?
Well, again, what the 2018 guideline states, they suggest eschewing, doing away completely with benzodiazepines. They want us to be choosing propofol or dexmedetomidine over those benzodiazepines for sedation in critically ill patients on mechanical ventilation. However, this is a conditional recommendation, low quality of evidence. They evaluated the effect of propofol versus benzodiazepine, dexmedetomidine versus benzodiazepine, and propofol versus dexmedetomidine. In most studies, benzos were given via usually continuous infusion and not really intermittent boluses. Compared with benzodiazepines, propofol was associated with a shorter time to light sedation and a shorter time to extubation. Compared with benzodiazepine, dexmedetomidine was associated with a shorter duration of mechanical ventilation and ICU length of stay. It's also associated with a significant reduction in delirium. They had a recent MENDS, M-E-N-D-S trial, which demonstrated greater incidence of bradycardia in the dexmedetomidine group. Current studies have not found that intervention has been required for bradycardia. So that's a good thing. Dexmedetomidine versus propofol, no difference in time to extubation. We also see a PRODEX study, P-R-O-D-E-X, which is really delirium incidence, was decreased with dexmedetomidine at a single time point, 48 hours after sedation cessation. Patients could communicate more effectively with dexmedetomidine, and again, showed no difference in this study in bradycardia.
That's excellent, Peter. So we really should be moving away from benzodiazepines. We also understand that some of you may practice in very limited resource settings, and all you have as a sedative in your critically ill patient is a benzodiazepine. But if given the choice, moving away from benzodiazepines in lieu of these recent recommendations or these guidelines, really reiterating the first choice either being propofol or dexmedetomidine, really having some outcome benefit on either of those agents compared to benzodiazepines. Rob, let me turn to you. So untreated pain, bad. Untreated agitation and anxiety, bad. We know that we may want to target lighter levels of sedation for many, maybe not all, but many of our critically ill patients, and we just went over the agents. Similar to pain, in the protocol assessment using those validated tools, do we see the same benefit in using a validated tool to assess agitation and anxiety? And if so, is there one particular one that you find yourself using more often?
Well, there are validated tools, and you're better off using a protocol-driven validated tool, one that has been shown to be reliable and validated across various populations. And the one that we use is the RAS score, and I think that's probably the case in most ICUs. And it's not necessarily that it's better than, say, some of the other scores. It just happens to be the one that is, I guess, more validated, that our nurses and our staff are more comfortable using.
And in terms of that RAS, I would wholeheartedly agree. I think this is probably what we all are using. Is there a certain range in terms of the RAS score that you're titrating to?
Yeah, most target a RAS of -2 to about +1, but it really just depends on your particular case. Like if, for example, you have a patient that you're really having a hard time ventilating and oxygenating, I might target even a deeper RAS. And conversely, if I have somebody that is very comfortable on the vent, and I'm planning to do a spontaneous ventilation trial, then I might target a higher RAS. So again, most people target around -2 to +1, but depending on your individual case and what you're trying to accomplish, I go outside of those ranges at times.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point in tailoring it to the individual patient. Notwithstanding, there was a study that we're not going to go into it deep dive on, but at the end of 2017, they specifically studied, does the depth of sedation in the ED actually, is it associated with adverse patient outcome? And no surprise, in that particular study, well over 60% of critically ill patients, I think vented patients actually, in those EDs that were studied were being taken way low in terms of their RAS score, -3, -4, -5. And it was actually associated with an increase in in-hospital mortality. So these things are very, very pertinent to the vented ED patient who is awaiting transfer upstairs. And while we're not going to say light sedation for all comers, certainly think about lighter sedation when clinically feasible or clinically possible, and that would be somewhere along the RAS score of about -2 to 1. Well, gentlemen, this has been incredibly helpful. We've got new guidelines just published within the last 6 months on treating pain as well as agitation and anxiety in our critically ill patients. John, can you bring us home with the key take-home points and pearls from this discussion?
Absolutely, Mike. So I think number one is fairly straightforward. It's assess pain first. Use whether or not it's a behavioral pain score or some sort of objective scoring criteria for pain, because routine physiologic measures such as patient's heart rate or blood pressure are often unreliable, particularly in the critically ill. So manage pain first. Start with opioids. Again, opioids are still remaining our first line treatment. Certainly consider some adjunctive treatments, but start off with your opioid therapy first as you're addressing pain. Certainly assess for anxiety and agitation after you feel like you've adequately addressed patient's pain using a validated protocol such as the Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale or the RAS score. We want to titrate to lighter levels of sedation if possible, but certainly there may be times shooting for a little your heavier sedation, for example, that post-arrest patient who's getting therapeutic hypothermia. Obviously, that wouldn't apply, but certainly in a majority of patients, I think we can often lighten up the sedation as soon as possible to keep the patient alert, oriented, and interactive. First line sedations should certainly include propofol and dexmedetomidine if available, and really avoid benzodiazepines as much as possible. For me personally, unless my patient's looking at me telling me I am anxious, I'm often not given the benzodiazepines. So moving towards propofol and dex or Presidex as a first line for sedation.
Outstanding way to wrap things up. Peter, then Rob, any final thoughts before we bring this podcast to a close?
Yes. One of the things that you mentioned before, Mike, just to drive home, that in the ED, as well as in the ICU, there is a tendency to oversedate our patients. And that oversedation does really correlate very well with increased days on mechanical ventilation and increased ICU days. So although I agree with everyone else that there are certain subsets of patients that need to be deep, if you're going to err, try and err on the lighter side to start.
Outstanding. Yes. And Rob, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I thought this was a great discussion. I like all the take-home points. And I guess my final thought is that as we protocolize things, remember to tailor your therapy to the individual patient. As we've discussed with our treatment of shock, we've discussed in our treatment of sepsis and antibiotic therapy and fluids, you really have to look at every individual patient and figure out what is the best cocktail to treat that patient with. That goes even more so with sedation and pain management. So while we like to have protocols and we like to have straightforward algorithms, I think it's always important to look at the individual patient and consider nuances in what you're trying to accomplish with them.
Well said. And with that, we are going to bring this podcast to a close. My thanks, gentlemen, for an outstanding discussion on the latest guidelines on a very, very important topic that we all confront in our critically ill patients, whether they're in the ED or in the ICU. If you have any questions for us regarding these guidelines, regarding what we talked about on this podcast, please shoot us an email through the website. And on behalf of Rob, Peter, John, and myself, I want to thank you for listening to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. We will look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.